on. The sound of random shots barely even registering now. No longer do they turn around to see who has fallen. As day breaks, they are brought to a halt in a field by a train track. An engine and several cattle wagons stand waiting.
They've brought me here. Now they will take me away, thinks Geeta.
She has learned that the four girls she is now traveling with are Polish and not Jewish. Polish girls taken from their families for reasons they do not know. They come from four different towns and hadn't known each other before Birkenau. Across the field stands a lone house. Behind it, a dense wood spreads out. SS bark out orders as the train engine is stoked with coal. The Polish girls turn to Geeta. One of them says,
"We're going to make a run for that house. If we get shot, then we will die here. But we're not going any further. Do you want to come with us?"
Geeta stands up. Once the girls are running, they don't look back. The act of loading thousands of exhausted women onto the train takes all the guards' attention. The door to the house is opened before they reach it. Inside, they collapse in front of a roaring fire, adrenaline and relief surging through them. Hot drinks are placed in their hands, along with bread. The Polish girls talk frantically to the homeowners, who shake their heads in disbelief. Geeta says nothing, not wanting her accent to give away the fact she isn't Polish. It's better their saviors think she is one of them, the quiet one. The man of the house says they can't stay with them, as the Germans often search the premises. He tells them to take their coats off. He takes them out the back of the house. When he returns, the red slashes are gone and the coats smell of petrol. Outside, they hear repeated shooting, and peering through the curtains, they watch as all surviving women are finally herded onto the train. Bodies litter the snow beside the tracks. The man gives the girls the address of a relative in a nearby village, as well as a supply of bread and a blanket. They leave the house and enter the woods, where they spend the night on the freezing ground, curled up together in a vain attempt to stay warm. The bare trees provide little in the way of protection, either from being seen or from the elements. It is early evening before they arrive in the next village. The sun has gone down and the weak street lamps cast little light. They are forced to ask a passerby for help finding the address they've been given. The kind woman takes them to the house they seek, and stays with them while they knock on the door.
"Look after them,"
she says when the door opens, then walks away. A woman stands aside as the girls enter her home. Once the door is closed, they explain who sent them here.
"Do you know who that was just now?"
the woman stammers.
"No,"
one of the girls answers.
"She's SS, a senior SS officer. Do you think she knows who we are?"
"She's not stupid. I've heard stories about her being one of the cruelest people in the concentration camps."
An elderly woman comes out of the kitchen.
"Mother, we have some guests. These poor things were in one of the camps. We must give them something warm to eat."
The older woman makes a fuss over the girls, taking them into the kitchen, sitting them at the table. Geeta can't remember the last time she sat on a chair at a kitchen table. From a stove, the older woman ladles hot soup for them, and then peppers them with questions. The owners decide it is not safe for them to stay here. They are afraid the SS officer will report the girl's presence. The older woman excuses herself and leaves the house. A short while later, she returns with a neighbor. Her house has both a roof cavity and a cellar. She is willing to let the five of them sleep in the roof. With the heat from the fireplace rising, it will be warmer up there than in the cellar. They won't be able to stay in the house during the day, though, as every house can be searched at any time by the Germans, even though they seem to be retreating. Geeta and her four Polish friends sleep in the roof space each night, and spend the days hiding in the nearby woods. Word sweeps through the small village, and the local priest has his parishioners bring food to the house owner each day. After a few weeks, the remaining Germans are flushed out by the advancing Russian soldiers, several of whom set up house in the property directly opposite where Gita and her friends sleep. One morning, the girls are late leaving for the woods and are stopped by a Russian standing guard outside the building. They show him their tattoos and try to explain where they have been and why they are here now. Compassionate to their plight, he offers to place a guard outside the house. This means they no longer have to spend their days in the woods. Where they live is no longer a secret, and they receive a smile or a wave from the soldiers when they come and go. One day, one of the soldiers asks Gita a direct question, and when she answers, he immediately recognizes that she isn't Polish. She tells him she is from Slovakia. That evening, he knocks on the door and introduces a young man dressed in a Russian uniform, but who is in fact from Slovakia. The two of them talk into the night. The girls have been pushing their luck in staying by the fire later into the evening. A degree of complacency has set in. One evening, they are caught off guard when the front door bursts open and a drunken Russian staggers in. The girls can see their guard lying unconscious outside. Waving a pistol, the intruder singles out one of the girls and attempts to rip her clothes off. At the same time, he drops his trousers. Gita and the others scream. Several Russian soldiers soon burst into the room. Seeing their comrade on top of one of the girls, one of them pulls out his pistol and shoots him in the head. He and his comrades drag the would-be rapist from the house, apologizing profusely. Traumatized, the girls decide they must move on. One of them had a sister living in Krakow. Maybe she is still there. As a further apology for the attack the previous night, a senior Russian soldier arranges a driver and a small truck to take them to Krakow. They find the sister, still living in her small apartment above a grocery store. The flat is crowded with people, friends who have fled the city and are now returning homeless. No one has any money. To get by, they visit a market every day and each steals one item of food. From these pickings, they make a nightly meal. One day at the market, Gita's ears prick up at the sound of her native language being spoken by a truck driver unloading produce. She learns from him that several trucks a week travel from Bratislava to Krakow, bringing fresh fruit and vegetables. He accepts her request to travel back with them. She runs and tells the people she has been living with that she's leaving. Saying goodbye to the four friends she escaped with is very difficult. They come with her to the market and wave her off as the truck carrying her and two of her countrymen leaves in the direction of a host of unknowns. She has long accepted that her parents and two young sisters are dead, but she prays that at least one of her brothers has survived. Becoming partisan fighters with the Russians might have kept them safe. In Bratislava, just as in Krakow, Gita joins other survivors of the camps in shared, crowded apartments. She registers her name and address with the Red Cross, having been told that all returning prisoners are doing this in the hope they can find missing relatives and friends. One afternoon, she looks out of her apartment window to see two young Russian soldiers jumping over the back fence into the property where she lives. She is terrified. But as they come closer, she recognizes her two brothers, Dodo and Laszlo. Running down the stairs, she flings open the door and hugs them with all her strength. They dare not stay, they tell her. Even though the Russians liberated the town from the Germans, the locals are suspicious of anyone wearing a Russian uniform. Not wanting to spoil the brief sweetness of their reunion, Gita keeps what she knows about the rest of the family to herself. They will find out soon enough, and this is not something to be spoken of in a few snatched minutes. Before they separate, Gita tells them how she too has worn a Russian uniform. It was the first clothing she was given on arrival at Auschwitz. She says she looked better in it than they do, and they all laugh. Chapter 26.
Lale's train moves across the countryside.
He leans against the compartment wall, fiddling with the two pouches tied inside his trousers that contain the gems he's risked bringing with him. The bulk of them he left under his mattress. Whoever searches his room can have them. Later that evening, the train grinds to a halt, and rifle-toting SS order everyone to scramble out, just as they had nearly 3 years ago in Birkenau. Another concentration camp.
One of the men in Lale's wagon jumps down with him.
I'll know this place. I've been here before.
Yeah?
Lale says.
Mauthausen in Austria. Not quite as terrible as Birkenau, but nearly.
I'm Lale.
Joseph, pleased to meet you.
Once the men have all disembarked, the SS wave them through, telling them to go and find themselves a place to sleep.
Lale follows Joseph into a block.
The men here are starving. Skin-covered skeletons, yet they still have enough life in them to be territorial.
Peace off! There's no room in here!
One man per bunk. Each claims his space and looks prepared to fight to defend it. Two more blocks elicit the same response. Finally, they find one with more space and claim their turf. As others come into the block searching for a place to sleep, they call out the accepted greeting,
"Piss off! We're full here!"
The next morning, Lale sees men from the blocks near him lining up.
He realizes he is to be strip-searched and asked for information about who he is and where he has come from. Again. From his gem pouches, he takes the three largest diamonds and puts them in his mouth. He rushes to the back of the block while the rest of the men are still gathering and scatters the remaining gems there. The inspection of the line of naked men begins. He watches the guards yanking open the mouths of those before him, so he rolls the diamonds under his tongue. He has his mouth open before the inspecting party reaches him. After a quick glance, they walk on by.
For several weeks, Lale, along with all the other prisoners, sit around doing virtually nothing.
Almost all he can do is watch, in particular the SS guarding them, and he tries to work out who can be approached and who must be avoided.
He starts to talk occasionally to one of them. The guard is impressed that Lale speaks fluent German. He has heard about Auschwitz and Birkenau. He has not been there and wants to hear about it. Lale paints a picture removed from reality.
Nothing can be gained by telling this German the true nature of the treatment of prisoners there. He tells him what he did there and how he much preferred to work than sit around. A few days later, the guard asks him if he'd like to move to a sub-camp of Mauthausen, at Saurer Werke in Vienna. Thinking it cannot be any worse than here, and with assurances from the guard that conditions are slightly better and the commandant is too old to care,
Lale accepts the offer.
The guard points out that this camp does not take Jews, so he should keep quiet about his religion.
The next day, the guard tells Lale,
"Gather your things. You are out of here."
Lale looks around. "Gathered."
"You leave by truck in about an hour. Line up at the gate. Your name is on the list."
He laughs.
"My name?"
"Yes. You need to keep your arm with its number hidden, okay?"
"I get to answer to my name?"
"Yes. Don't forget. Good luck."
"Before you go, I'd like to give you something."
The guard looks perplexed.
From his mouth, Lale takes a diamond, wipes it on his shirt and hands it to him.
"Now you can't say you never got anything from a Jew."
Vienna. Who wouldn't want to visit Vienna? It was a dream destination for Lale in his playboy days.
The very word sounds romantic, full of style and possibility. But he knows it will now fail to live up to this perception.
The guards are indifferent to Lale and the others when they arrive. They find a block and are told where and when to get their meals. Lale's thoughts are dominated by Gita and by how he can get to her.
Being shunted from camp to camp to camp He cannot bear it much longer. For several days he observes his surroundings. He sees the camp commandant doddering about and wonders how he is still breathing. He chats to amenable guards and tries to understand the dynamic among the prisoners. Once he discovers he is probably the only Slovakian prisoner here, he decides to keep to himself.
Poles, Russians, and a few Italians sit around all day, talking with their countrymen, leaving Lale largely isolated.
One day, two young men sidle up to him.
They say you were the Tetoviera at Auschwitz.
Who are they?
Someone said they thought they knew you there, and that you tattooed the prisoners.
Lale grabs the young man's hand and pulls up his sleeve. No number. He turns to the second man.
What about you? Were you there?
No. But is it true what they say?
I was the Tetoviera. But so what?
Nothing. Just asking.
The boys walk away. Lale goes back to his daydreaming.
He doesn't see the approaching SS officers until they yank him to his feet and frog march him to a nearby building.
Lale finds himself standing in front of the aging commandant, who nods to one of the SS officers. The officer pulls up Lale's sleeve, revealing his number.
You were in Auschwitz?
The commandant asks. Yes, sir.
Were you the Tetoviera there?
Yes, sir.
So, you are a Jew?
No, sir. I am a Catholic. The commandant raises a brow.
Oh? I didn't know they had Catholics in Auschwitz.
They had all religions there, sir, along with criminals and politicals.
Are you a criminal?
No, sir.
And you are not a Jew?
No, sir, I'm Catholic.
You have answered no twice. I will ask you only once more. Are you a Jew?
No, I am not. Here, let me prove it to you.
With that, Lale undoes the string holding up his trousers and they fall to the floor.
He hooks his fingers into the back of his underpants and starts to pull them down.
Stop! I don't need to see. Okay, you can go.
Pulling his trousers back up, trying to control his breathing, which threatens to give him away, Lale hurries from the office.
In an outer office, he stops and slumps in a chair. The officer behind a nearby desk looks at him.
Are you all right?
Yes, I'm good, just a bit dizzy. Do you know what the date is?
It's the 22nd, no, wait, the 23rd of April, why?
Nothing. Thanks. Goodbye.
Outside, Lale looks at the prisoners sitting lazily around the compound and at the guards who look even lazier.
3 years. You've taken 3 years of my life. You will not have one more day.
At the back of the blocks, Lale walks along the fence, shaking it, looking for a weak point. It doesn't take him long to find one.
The fence comes away at ground level, and he is able to pull it towards him. Not even bothering to see if anyone is watching, he crawls under and walks calmly away. Forest provides him with cover from any patrolling Germans. As he walks deeper in, he hears the sound of cannons and rifle fire. He doesn't know whether to walk towards it or run the other way. During a brief ceasefire, he hears the running of a stream. To reach it, he must get closer to the shooting. But he's always had a good internal compass, and that direction feels right. If it is the Russians, or even the Americans on the other side of the stream, he will gladly surrender to them. As the daylight fades into evening, he can see the flash of gunfire and cannons in the distance. Still, it is the water he wants to get to, and hopefully a bridge and a route away. When he gets there, a river confronts him rather than a stream, He looks across and listens to the cannon fire.
It must be the Russians. I'm coming your way.
Lowering himself into the water, Lale is shocked at the freezing cold. He swims slowly out into the river, careful not to disturb the water too much with his strokes in case he's seen.
Pausing, he raises his head and listens. The gunfire is closer.
Shit,
he mutters. He stops swimming and lets the current carry him directly under the crossfire. Just another log or dead body to be ignored. When he thinks he has safely cleared the warring armies, he swims frantically to the far bank. He hauls himself out and drags his drenched body into the trees before collapsing in shivers and passing out. Chapter 27.
Lale wakes to the feeling of the sun on his face.
His clothes have dried out a bit, and he can hear the sound of the river running below him. He crawls on his belly through the trees that have hidden him overnight and reaches the crest of a road. Russian soldiers are walking along it. He watches for a few moments, fearing gunfire. But the soldiers are relaxed. He decides to accelerate his plan to get home.
Lale raises his hands and steps out onto the road, startling a group of soldiers.
They raise their rifles immediately.
I am Slovakian. I have been in a concentration camp for 3 years.
The soldiers exchange glances.
Fuck off,
one of them says, and they resume their march, one of them shoving Lale as he goes by.
He stands for several minutes as many more soldiers walk past, ignoring him. Accepting their indifference, he carries on, receiving only an occasional glance. He decides to walk in the opposite direction to them, reasoning that the Russians are probably heading to engage with the Germans, so getting as far away as possible makes sense. Eventually a jeep pulls up alongside him and stops. An officer in the back eyeballs him.
Who the hell are you?
I'm Slovakian. I have been a prisoner in Auschwitz for 3 years.
He pulls up his left sleeve to reveal his tattooed number.
Never heard of it.
Lale swallows. It's unimaginable to him that a place of such horror should not be known.
It's in Poland, that's all I can tell you.
You speak perfect Russian, the soldier says. Any other languages?
Czech, German, French, Hungarian and Polish.
The officer eyes him more carefully.
And where do you think you're going?
Home? Back to Slovakia?
No, you're not. I have just a job for you. Get in.
Lale wants to run,
but he would have no chance. So he climbs into the passenger seat.
Turn around, back to headquarters,
the officer instructs the driver. The jeep bumps over potholes and ditches, heading back the way it has come. A few kilometers further on, they pass through a small village, and then turn up a dirt road towards a large chalet that sits on the top of a hill overlooking a beautiful valley. They enter a large circular driveway where several expensive-looking cars are parked. Two guards stand either side of an imposing main doorway. The jeep skids to a stop. The driver scrambles out and opens the door for the officer in the back.
Come with me,
the officer says.
Lale scurries after him into the foyer of the chalet.
He pauses, shocked by the opulence before him. A grand staircase, works of art, paintings and tapestries on every wall, and furniture of a quality he has never seen before.
Lale has stepped into a world beyond his comprehension. After what he has known, it's almost painful. The officer heads towards a room off the main foyer, indicating that Lale should follow. They enter a large, exquisitely furnished room. A mahogany desk dominates, as does the person sitting behind it. Judging by his uniform and accompanying insignia, Lale is in the presence of a very senior Russian official. The man looks up as they enter.
Who have we here? He claims he was a prisoner of the Nazis for 3 years. I suspect he's a Jew, but I don't think that matters. What does matter is that he speaks both Russian and German, the officer says. And? I thought he could be useful to us, you know, in talking to the locals. The senior officer leans back, seems to consider this. Put him to work, then. Find someone to guard him and shoot him if he tries to escape.
As Lale is escorted from the room, the senior officer adds,
And get him cleaned up, and into some better clothes. Yes, sir. I think he will do well for us.
Lale follows the officer.
I don't know what they want from me, but if it means a bath and clean clothes...
They walk across the foyer and head upstairs to the first floor landing. Lale notes that there are 2 further floors.
They enter a bedroom and the Russian goes to the closet and opens it. Women's clothing. Without a word, he leaves and enters the next bedroom. This time, men's clothes.
Find something that fits you and looks good. There should be a bathroom through there, he points. Clean yourself up and I'll be back in a short while.
He closes the door behind him. Lale looks around the room.
There is a large 4-poster bed draped in heavy covers, and with mountains of pillows of all shapes and sizes. A chest of drawers he thinks might be solid ebony, a small table complete with Tiffany lamp, and a lounge chair covered in exquisite embroidery. How he wishes Gita were here. He stifles the thought. He cannot afford to think of her, not yet.
Lale runs his hands over the suits and shirts in the closet, both casual and formal, and all the accessories needed to resurrect the Lale of old.
He selects a suit and holds it up to the mirror, admiring the look. It will be close to a perfect fit. He throws it onto the bed. A white shirt soon joins it. From a drawer, he selects soft underpants, crisp socks, and a smooth brown leather belt. He finds a polished pair of shoes in another cupboard, a match for the suit. He slips his bare feet into them. Perfect. A door leads to the bathroom. Gold fittings glisten against the white tiles that cover the walls and floor. A large stained glass window casts pale yellow and dark green light around the room from the late afternoon sun. He enters the room and stands still for a long time, enjoying the anticipation. Then he runs a deep bath and lowers himself into it, luxuriating in it until the water cools. He adds more steaming water, in no hurry for his first bath in 3 years to end. Eventually he climbs out and dries himself with a soft towel that he finds hanging with several others on the rail. He walks back into the bedroom and dresses slowly, savoring the feel of smooth cotton and linen and woolen socks. Nothing scratches, irritates, or hangs baggily off his shrunken frame. Clearly the owner of these clothes was slim. He sits for a while on the bed, waiting for his minder to return. Then he decides to explore the room some more. He pulls back large drapes to reveal French windows that lead out onto a balcony. He opens the doors with a flourish and steps outside.
Wow. Where am I?
An immaculate garden stretches out before him, lawn disappearing into a forest. He has a perfect view down onto the circular drive, and he watches as several cars pull up and deposit more Russian officials. He hears the door to his room opening, and turns around to see his minder alongside another lower-ranked soldier. He stays on the balcony. The two men join him and look out over the grounds.
Very nice, don't you think?
Lale's minder says.
You've done well for yourselves. Quite a find. His minder laughs.
Yes, we have. This headquarters is a bit more comfortable than the one we had at the front.
Are you going to tell me where I fit in?
This is Friedrich. He's going to be your guard. He will shoot you if you try to escape.
Lale looks at the man, his arm muscles bulge against his shirt sleeves, and his chest threatens to pop the buttons that hold it in. His thin lips neither smile nor grimace. Lale's nod of greeting isn't returned.
He will not only guard you here, but he will take you to the village each day to make our purchases. Do you understand?
What am I buying?
Well, it's not wine. We have a cellar full of that. Food, the chefs will buy. They know what they want.
So that leaves...
entertainment.
Lale keeps his face neutral.
You will go into the village each morning to find lovely young ladies interested in spending some time here with us in the evening. Understand? I'm to be your pimp. You understand perfectly.
How am I to persuade them?
Tell them you are all good-looking fellows who will treat them well.
We will give you things to entice them.
What sort of things?
Come with me.
The three men walk back downstairs to another sumptuous room, where an officer opens a large vault set into a wall. The minder enters the vault and brings out two metal tins, which he places on the desk.
In one, there is currency. In the other, jewelry. Lale can see many other similar tins shelved in the vault.
Friedrich will bring you here each morning, and you will take both money and jewelry for the girls. We need 8 to 10 each night. Just show them the payment, and if need be, give them a small amount of money in advance. Tell them they will be paid in full when they arrive at the chalet, and when the evening is over, they will be returned to their homes, safe and well.
Lale attempts to reach into the jewelry tin, which is promptly slammed shut.
Have you struck a rate with them already? He asks.
I'll leave that to you to figure out. Just get the best deal you can. Understand?
Sure. You'd like prime beef for the price of sausage.
Lale knows the right thing to say.
The officer laughs.
Go with Friedrich. He'll show you around. You can take your meals in the kitchen or in your room. Let the chefs know.
Friedrich takes Lale downstairs and introduces him to two of the chefs. He tells them he would prefer to eat in his room. Friedrich tells Lale that he must not go above the first floor, and even there, he is to enter no room but his own. He gets the message loud and clear. A few hours later, Lale is brought a meal of lamb in a thick, creamy sauce.
The carrots are cooked al dente and drip with butter. The whole dish is garnished with salt, pepper, and fresh parsley. He had wondered if he might have lost the ability to appreciate rich flavors. He hasn't. What he has lost, however, is the ability to enjoy the food before him. How can he, when Geeta is not there to share it with him? When he has no idea whether she has anything to eat at all. When he has no idea, but he suppresses that thought. He is here now, and he must do what he has to do before he can find her. He only eats half of what's on his plate. Always save some. That is how he has lived these past years.
Along with the food, Lale drinks most of a bottle of wine.
It takes some effort to undress himself before he flops onto his bed and enters the sleep of the intoxicated. He is woken the next morning by the clang of a breakfast tray being placed on the table. He can't remember if he locked his room or not. Perhaps the chef has a key anyway. The evening's empty tray and bottle are taken away, all without a word. After breakfast, he takes a quick shower. He is slipping on his shoes when Friedrich walks in.
Ready?
Lale nods. Let's go.
First stop. The study with the vault.
Friedrich and another officer look on as Lale selects a quantity of cash,
which is counted and noted in a ledger, then a combination of small items of jewelry, and a few loose gems, also noted.
I'm taking more than I probably need because it's my first time and I have no idea what the going rate is, okay?
He says to both men. They shrug.
Just make sure you return anything you don't give away, the accountant officer says.
Putting the money in one pocket and the jewels in another,
Lale follows Friedrich to a large garage block by the chalet. Friedrich commandeers a jeep. Lale gets in, and they drive the few kilometers into the village Lale came through yesterday.
Was it only yesterday? How can I feel so different already? During the journey, Friedrich tells him they will drive a small truck in to pick up the girls in the evening. It isn't comfortable, but it's the only vehicle they have that can take 12.
As they enter the village, Lale asks,
"So where should I look for likely girls?"
"I'll drop you at the top of the street. Go into all the shops, workers or customers, it doesn't matter as long as they are young and preferably pretty. Find their price, show them the payment. If they want something up front, give them cash only. Tell them we will pick them up at 6 o'clock outside the bakery. Some have been before."
"How will I know if they're already attached?"
"They'll say no, I'm thinking. They might also throw something at you, so be prepared to duck."
As Lale gets out, he says,
"I'll be waiting and watching. Take your time, and don't do anything stupid."
Lale heads to a nearby boutique, hoping no husbands or boyfriends have gone shopping with their partners today.
Everyone looks at him when he enters. He says hello in Russian, before remembering he's in Austria and switching to German.
"Hello, ladies. How are you today?"
The women look at each other. A few giggle before the shop attendant asks,
"Can I help you? Are you looking for something for your wife?"
"Not exactly. I want to talk to all of you."
"Are you Russian?"
a customer asks.
"No, I'm Slovakian. However, I am here on behalf of the Russian army."
"Are you staying at the chalet?"
asks another customer.
"Yes."
To Lale's relief, one of the shop attendants speaks up.
"Are you here to see if we want to party tonight?"
"Yes. Yes, I am. Have you been before?"
"I have." "Don't look so frightened. We all know what you want."
Lale looks around.
There are 2 shop assistants and 4 customers.
"Well,"
he says cautiously.
"Show us what you've got,"
a customer says.
Lale empties his pockets onto the counter as the girls gather around.
"How much can we have?"
Lale looks at the girl who has been to the chalet before.
"How much were you paid last time?"
She waves a diamond and pearl ring under his nose.
"Plus 10 marks.
"Okay. How about I give you 5 marks now, another 5 tonight, and your choice of a piece of jewelry?"
The girl rummages through and picks out a pearl bracelet.
"I'll have this one."
Lale takes it gently from her hand.
"Not yet," he says. "Be at the bakery at 6 tonight. Deal?"
"Deal,"
she says.
Lale hands her 5 marks, which she stuffs down her bra. The remaining girls peruse the jewelry and choose what they want. Lale gives them each 5 marks. There is no haggling.
"Thank you, ladies. Before I leave, can you tell me where I might find some like-minded beauties?"
"You could try the cafe a few doors down, or the library,"
one of them suggests.
"Be careful of the grandmas in the cafe,"
one woman says with a giggle.
"What do you mean, grandmas?"
Lale asks.
"You know, old women. Some of them are over 30.
Lale smiles.
"Look," says the original volunteer, "you could stop any woman you meet in the street. We all know what you want. And there are plenty of us who need good food and drink, even if we have to share it with those ugly Russian pigs. There are no men left here to help us. We do what we have to."
"As do I,"
Lale tells them.
"Thank you all very much. I'll look forward to seeing you tonight."
Lale leaves the shop and leans against a wall, taking a breather.
One shop, half the girls required. He looks to the other side of the street. Friedrich is looking at him. He gives him a thumbs up. Now, where's that cafe?
On his walk there, Lale stops three young women, two of whom agreed to come to the party.
In the cafe he finds three more. He thinks they are in their low to mid-30s, but still beautiful women anyone would want to be seen with.
That evening, Lale and Friedrich pick up the women, who are all waiting at the bakery, as instructed.
They are elegantly dressed and made up. The agreed transaction in jewelry and cash takes place with minimal scrutiny from Friedrich. He watches as they enter the chalet. They are holding hands, wearing resolute expressions and occasionally laughing.
"I'll take what's left over,"
Friedrich says, standing close to Lale. Lale takes several notes and a couple of pieces of jewelry from his pockets and hands them to Friedrich, who seems satisfied the transactions have been carried out correctly. Friedrich pockets the goods, then sets about patting Lale down, digging his hands deep into his pockets.
"Hey, careful," says Lale. "I don't know you that well."
"You're not my type."
The kitchen must have been told about his return, as his supper arrives shortly after Lale has entered his room.
He eats and then walks out onto the balcony. Leaning on the balustrade, he watches the comings and goings of vehicles. Occasionally the sound of the partying below filters up to him, and he is pleased that he hears only laughter and conversation. Back in his room, he begins to undress for bed. Fiddling around in the cuff of his trousers, he finds the small diamond he has placed there. He takes a single sock out of the drawer and stuffs the diamond into it before retiring for the night. He is woken a few hours later by laughter and chatter coming through his balcony doors. He steps outside and watches as the girls clamber aboard the truck for the trip home. Most seem intoxicated, but none look distressed. He goes back to bed.
For the next several weeks, Lale and Friedrich make their twice daily trips into the village.
He becomes well known there. Even women who never come to the chalet know who he is and greet him in passing. The boutique and the cafe are his two favorite places, and soon girls gather there at the time they know he will arrive. He is often greeted by his regulars with a kiss on the cheek and a request for him to join the partying that night. They seem genuinely upset that he never does.
One day in the cafe, Serena, a waitress there, says loudly, "Lale, will you marry me when the war is over?" The other girls there giggle, and the older women tut. "She's falling for you, Lale. She doesn't want any of those Russian pigs, no matter how much money they have," one of the customers adds.
"You are a very beautiful girl, Serena. But I'm afraid my heart belongs to someone else."
"Who? What is her name?"
asks Serena indignantly.
"Her name is Gita, and I am promised to her. I love her."
"Is she waiting for you? Where is she?"
"I don't know where she is right now, but I'll find her."
"How do you even know if she's alive?"
"Oh, she's alive. Have you ever just known something?"
"I'm not sure."
"Then you've never been in love."
"I'll see you girls later. 6 o'clock. Don't be late." A chorus of goodbyes follows him out the door.
That night, as Lale adds a large ruby to his war chest, a terrible homesickness overtakes him.
He sits on his bed for a long time. His memories of home have been tainted by his memories of the war. Everything and everyone he cared for is now only visible to him through glasses darkened by suffering and loss. When he manages to pull himself together, he empties the sock onto his bed and counts the gems he has managed to smuggle over the weeks. Then he wanders out onto the balcony. The nights are getting warmer, and several of the partygoers are out on the lawn, some lounging about, others playing a kind of chase game. A knock on his bedroom door startles him.
Since the first night, Lale has locked his door whether he is in the room or not. Rushing to open the door, Lale sees the gems on his bed and quickly pulls the covers over them. He doesn't spot the latest ruby falling onto the floor.
Why was your door locked? Friedrich asks.
I do not want to find myself sharing my bed with one of your colleagues, several of whom I have observed have no interest in the girls we bring them.
I see. You are a good-looking man. You know they would reward you handsomely if you were so inclined.
I'm not.
Would you like one of the girls? They've already been paid.
No. Thanks.
Friedrich's eye is caught by a sparkling from the rug. He bends down and picks up the ruby.
Yet what is this?
Lale looks at the gem, surprised.
Can you explain why you've got this, Lale?
It must have got caught in the lining of my pocket.
Really?
Do you think if I had taken it, I would have left it there for you to find?
Friedrich considers him.
I suppose not.
He pockets it.
I'll return it to the vault.
What did you want to see me about? Lale asks, changing the topic.
I'm being transferred tomorrow, so you'll be doing the morning run and pick up on your own from now on.
You mean with someone else? Asks Lale.
No. You've proven you can be trusted. The general's very impressed with you. Just keep doing what you're doing, and when it's time for everyone to leave here, there might even be a little bonus for you.
I'm sorry to see you go. I've enjoyed our conversations in the truck. Look after yourself. There's still a war going on out there.
They shake hands.
Once Lale is alone, securely locked in his room, he gathers up the gems on his bed and puts them back in the sock.
From the closet, he chooses the nicest-looking suit and puts it aside. He lays a shirt and several pairs of underpants and socks on the table and slots a pair of shoes underneath it.
The next morning, Lale showers and dresses in his chosen clothes, including four pairs of underpants and three pairs of socks.
He puts the sock containing the gems into his inside jacket pocket. He takes one last look around his room and then makes his way to the vault.
Lale helps himself to his normal amount of money and jewels and is about to leave when the accountant officer stops him.
Wait! Take extra today. We have two very senior officers from Moscow arriving this afternoon. Buy them the best.
Lale takes the extra money and jewels.
I might be a little bit late back this morning. I'm going to the library as well to see if I can borrow a book.
We've got a perfectly good library here.
Thanks, but there are always officers in there and, well, I still find them intimidating. You understand?
Oh, okay, as you wish.
Lale walks into the garage and nods to the attendant who is busy washing a car.
Lovely day, Lale. Keys are in the jeep. I hear you're going alone today.
Yes, Friedrich's been transferred. Sure, hope it isn't to the front.
The attendant laughs.
Just be his rotten luck.
Oh, I've got permission to be back later than usual today.
Want a bit of action for yourself, do you?
Something like that.
See you later. Okay. Have a good day.
Lale hops casually into the jeep and drives away from the chalet without looking back.
In the village, he parks at the end of the main street, leaves the keys in the ignition, and walks away. He spots a bicycle leaning outside a shop, which he casually wheels away. Then he hops on and cycles out of town. A few kilometers away, he is stopped by a Russian patrol. A young officer challenges him.
Where are you going?
I have been a prisoner of the Germans for 3 years. I am from Slovakia, and I'm going home.
The Russian grabs hold of the handlebars, forcing Lale to dismount. He turns away from him and receives a firm kick up the bum.
The walk will do you good. Now fuck off.
Lale walks on.
Not worth arguing.
Evening arrives and he does not stop walking. He could see the lights of a small town ahead and picks up his pace. The place is crawling with Russian soldiers, and even though they ignore him, he feels he must move on. On the outskirts of town, he comes across a railway station and hurries over to it, thinking he might find a bench to lay his head for a few hours. Walking out onto a platform, he finds a train alongside, but no signs of life. The train fills him with foreboding, but he represses the fear and walks up and down, peering inside. Carriages. Carriages designed for people. A light in the nearby station office catches his attention, and he walks towards it. Inside, a station master rocks on a chair, his head dropping forward as he fights the need to sleep.
Lale steps back from the window and fakes a coughing fit before approaching with a confidence he doesn't really feel.
The station master, now awake, comes to the window, opening it just enough for a conversation.
Can I help you?
The train.
Where is it headed?
Bratislava.
Can I travel on it? Can you pay?
Lale pulls the sock from his jacket, extracts two diamonds, and hands them to him.
As he does so, the sleeve on his left arm rides up, revealing his tattoo. The station master takes the gems.
The end carriage. No one will bother you there. It's not leaving until 6 in the morning, though.
Lale glances at the clock inside the station. 8 hours away.
I can wait. How long is the journey?
About 1.5 hours.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As Lale is heading for the end carriage, he is stopped by a call from the station master, who catches up to him and hands him food and a thermos.
It's just a sandwich the wife made, but the coffee's hot and strong.
Taking the food and coffee, Lale's shoulders sag, and he can't hold back the tears.
He looks up to see the station master also has tears in his eyes as he turns away, heading back to his office.
Thank you.
He can barely get the words out.
Day breaks as they reach the border with Slovakia. An official approaches Lale and asks for his papers. Lale rolls up his sleeve to show his only form of identification. 32407.
I'm Slovakian, he says.
Welcome home.
Chapter 28.
Bratislava. Lale steps off the train into the city where he has lived and been happy, where his life should have been playing out for the last 3 years.
He wanders through districts he used to know so well. Many are now barely recognizable due to bombing. There is nothing here for him. He has to find a way back to Krompachi, some 250 miles away. It will be a long trip home. It takes him 4 days of walking, interspersed with occasional rides in horse-drawn carriages, a ride bareback on a horse and one on a tractor-drawn cart. He pays, when he needs to, the only way he can, a diamond here, an emerald there. Eventually he walks down the street he grew up in and stands across from his family home. The palings on the front fence are gone, leaving just the twisted posts. The flowers, once his mother's pride and joy, are strangled by weeds and overgrown grass. Rough timber is nailed over a broken window. An elderly woman comes out of the house opposite and stomps over to him.
What do you think you're doing? Away with you!
She screams, brandishing a wooden spoon.
I'm sorry, it's just... I used to live here.
The old lady peers at him, recognition dawning.
Lale? Is that you?
Yes. Oh, Mrs. Molnar. Is that you? You look...
Old. I know. Oh, my lord. Lale, is it really you?
They embrace. In choking voices, they ask each other how they are, without either letting the other answer properly. Finally, his neighbor pulls away from him.
What are you doing standing out here?
Go on in. Go home.
Is anyone living there?
Your sister, of course.
Oh, my. She doesn't know you're alive?
My sister.
Goldie is alive?
Lale runs across the street and knocks loudly on the door.
When no one answers immediately, he knocks again. From inside, he hears,
I'm coming! I'm coming!
Goldie opens the door. At the sight of her brother, she faints. Mrs. Molnar follows him inside as he picks his sister up and lays her on the sofa. Mrs. Molnar brings a glass of water.
Cradling Goldie's head lovingly in his arms, Lale waits for her to open her eyes. When she comes to, he offers her the water. She sobs, spilling most of it. Mrs. Molnar lets herself quietly out as Lale rocks his sister, letting his own tears flow too.
It is quite some time before he can speak and ask the questions he so desperately wants answers to. The news is bleak. His parents were taken away only days after he left. Goldie has no idea where they went, or if they are still alive. Max went off to join the partisans and was killed fighting the Germans. Max's wife and their two small boys were taken. Again, she does not know where to. The only positive news Goldie has to offer is her own. She fell in love with a Russian, and they are married. Her name is now Sokolov. Her husband is away on business and is due back in a few days.
Lale follows her into the kitchen, not wanting to let her out of his sight as she prepares a meal for them. After they have eaten, they talk late into the night. As much as Goldie pushes Lale for information about where he's been for the past 3 years, he will only say he has been in a work camp in Poland, and that he is now home.
The next day he pours his heart out to both his sister and Mrs. Molnar about his love for Gita, and how he believes she's still alive.
You have to find her, Goldie says. You must look for her.
I don't know where to start looking.
Well, where did she come from?
Mrs. Molnar asks.
I don't know, she wouldn't tell me.
Help me to understand this. You have known her 3 years, and in all that time she told you nothing about her origins?
She wouldn't. She was meant to tell me on the day she left the camp, but everything happened too quickly. All I know is her surname. It's Furman.
Well, that's something, but not much,
his sister chides him.
I've heard that people are starting to come home from the camps, says Mrs. Molnar. They are all arriving in Bratislava. Maybe she's there.
If I'm to go back to Bratislava, I need transport.
Goldie smiles.
So what are you doing sitting here, then?
In the town, Lale asks everyone he sees with a horse, bike, car, truck, if he can buy it from them.
They all refuse. As he's starting to despair, an old man comes towards him in a small cart drawn by a single horse.
Lale steps in front of the animal, forcing the man to rein it in.
I'd like to buy your horse and cart, he blurts out.
How much?
Lale pulls several gems from his pocket.
They are real, and worth a lot of money.
After inspecting the treasure, the old man says,
On one condition.
What? Anything.
You have to take me home first.
A short while later, Lale pulls up outside his sister's house and proudly shows off his new means of transport.
I haven't got anything for him to eat,
she exclaims. He points to the long grass.
Your front yard needs mowing.
That night, with the horse tethered in the front yard, Mrs. Molnar and Goldie set about making meals for Lale to take on his journey.